content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today we'll be reading articles from Volume 57, Number 1, the Fall 2017 issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian, Carolina Style, What Stories Do Our Clothes Tell?, produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. First article, From Frock Coats to Flip-Flops, 100 Years of Fashion at Carolina. By Linda Jacobson and Emily Jack. Linda Jacobson manages the exhibits and collections of the North Carolina Collection Gallery on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Emily Jack uses Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and the Internet to promote the North Carolina Collection Gallery. Close your eyes and picture a group of college students. What are they wearing? Shorts, jeans, yoga pants, flip-flops. What college students wear to class today is not too different from what they would wear to the beach or to an amusement park, but it wasn't always that way. What used to be considered casual is now considered dressy, and what is now considered casual once would have been unthinkable to wear in public, let alone to a class at a university. During the 20th century, ideas about appropriate dress on the college campus changed dramatically. In 1900, students at the University of North Carolina dressed with little variety and in ways that appear formal to us today. By 1999, casual style was everywhere, and individual expression was the norm. These changes in fashion reflected larger changes in American culture, but they also changed American culture. Early to mid-20th century. The 1902 photograph of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity shows how elegantly students at Carolina once dressed. Like the older adults pictured, students are wearing three-piece suits consisting of a jacket, pants, and buttoned-up vest. Accessories such as detachable stiff collars, bowler hats, and sometimes even walking canes completed the look. These young men appeared rather formal to us, but in the early 1900s, such outfits defined proper and respectable everyday dress. We can only imagine how uncomfortable these layers were on hot and humid days in North Carolina. After World War I, college students at Carolina and across the nation adopted a youthful and more relaxed style of dress. Young people rejected many of the values of their parents' generation and began making their own rules about dating, dancing, and clothing. Although the three-piece suit was still an important part of the well-dressed college man's wardrobe, male students began wearing colorful patterned ties with softer shirts and shorter collars. Baggy-kneed short pants called knickers, worn with knit pullovers known as sweaters, clothing previously only seen on the golf course and tennis courts, became popular. The changes in women's styles were even more extreme. Women cut their hair short and began wearing loose-fitting dresses shortened to the knee, a big change from the modest styles of the first two decades of the 20th century. The Great Depression of the 1930s affected Americans from all walks of life, and financial hardship limited the money available to spend on clothes. Still, college students cared about looking good and copied the styles seen on actors in Hollywood movies and in men's and ladies' magazines such as Esquire and Mademoiselle. College shops opened in department stores to cater to students' desire to wear the latest fashions. A new type of casual clothing known as sportswear became popular. For women, low-heeled shoes and separately sold items of clothing such as sweaters and skirts were comfortable and practical for getting across campus. The United States' entry into World War II in 1941 brought about some changes, both to the UNC campus and to fashion. As young male students left for the war, the female population on campus greatly increased. Clothing styles remained similar to those of the 1930s, but with an important change. Clothes were pared down to conserve fabric. For example, women's skirts were shortened. Cuffs on men's pants were eliminated, and the number of pockets on garments were reduced. When veterans returned to campus after the war in 1945-46, they brought their military styles with them, including cropped jackets and khaki pants. Fashions for women in the 1950s and early 1960s ranged from cotton dresses with full skirts to form-fitting skirts worn with cashmere pullovers. College girls were among the first women to begin wearing pants and the knee-length short pants known as Bermuda shorts. Female students were not allowed to wear shorts or pants to class, the dining hall, or even to sporting activities such as football games. It would be the late 1960s before these restrictions were lifted. The 1970s. The late 1960s and early 1970s brought about the 20th century's biggest shift in student fashion toward casual styles of dress. The spark that ignited these changes was a national debate about American involvement in the Vietnam War. Students at Carolina and other college campuses across the nation began protesting against the war and began to question traditional attitudes about other things, including acceptable styles of dressing. The new fashion borrowed from other time periods, classes, and cultures. The more shocking it was, the better. Skirts became shockingly short. Hair became shockingly long for both women and men. Indian print fabrics, unisex t-shirts, beads, feathers, and tie-dyed garments replaced the modest styles of the past. Blue jeans, which had once been working-class attire, became the basis of the new hippie look, adopted as a sign of solidarity with working people. Inspired by the National Black Power Movement, many African American students questioned American beauty standards that valued only white European looks. They expressed an appreciation for their African heritage through Afro hairstyles, which emphasized the beauty of kinky curly hair, and through traditional West African garments such as the dashiki. Around 1973, the outlandishness of the hippies settled down and a calmer style emerged, but the idea of self-expression still held sway. By the time the 1970s ended, the trend toward a more casual college style had made a huge leap forward. The 1980s. By the 1980s, there were more ways than ever to express identity through dress. Carolina students borrowed from styles of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, even as they invented new ways to express themselves. Dressing to look wealthy became a prominent trend in the 1980s, and the term preppy described people whose clothing mimicked the classic look of prep school students. Extravagant style and big hair replaced the casual and natural looks of the 1970s. Popular culture also influenced college fashions. The birth of MTV, music television, brought the cutting-edge styles of musicians into Americans' lives 24 hours a day. Musical styles like rock, pop, rap, punk, and new wave each brought their own fashion trends. Rappers such as Run-DMC wore sneakers with thick laces and nylon jumpsuits. Punk bands donned ripped clothing riddled with safety pins. And pop queens like Madonna and Cyndi Lauper dressed in a mix of vintage and new clothing with bold jewelry and fabric head wraps. For many Carolina students in the 80s, daily dress on campus consisted of jeans worn with t-shirts or sweatshirts. The increasing casualization of college attire made flip-flops, once reserved for the pool or the beach, newly popular on campus. The 1990s. In the 1990s, no one look dominated. Young people, whether they were goths, skateboarders, hippies, or ravers, found many avenues for self-expression, including body modifications like tattoos and piercings. The rise of the World Wide Web supported the splintering of styles, providing more opportunities for people to connect with affinity groups and track down hard-to-find clothing items. Two prominent style stories of the decade were the influence of grunge music and hip-hop on fashion. Grunge musicians and their fans wore thrift store-sourced clothing, Doc Marten boots, torn jeans, vintage nylon slips, and ripped tights. After the breakthrough success of bands such as Nirvana, the look became popular on college campuses across the United States. Hip-hop, which had grown up from a scrappy street subculture into a dominant music genre, also heavily influenced style in the 1990s. Men's hip-hop fashion consisted of extremely oversized clothing with loose jeans worn baggy at the ankle, heavy boots or athletic shoes, and baseball caps. Women also wore baggy clothing along with chunky gold hoop earrings and other prominent jewelry. By the end of the 20th century, the unstoppable march from formal to casual dress had completely changed the look of the college campus. But the meaning of college had changed too, and the variety of professions that required a college degree had expanded dramatically. The student body at UNC no longer consisted solely of white men from wealthy families training to be doctors and lawyers, but it had expanded to become more reflective of the American population. And after 100 years of changing fashion, students were now free to express the richness and diversity of that population in their clothing. Here are the captions from the photographs that accompany this article. Beta Theta Pi fraternity students were professors and town members, 1902. Notice the tall collars, some as high as 4 inches tall. Students posed in the 1942 edition of the Yakety Yak yearbook. Fashion show 1937. Three students pose outside of a campus dormitory. The student at right is wearing a monogram sweater, which was awarded to students who excelled at sports. Students dress up in suits and ties and dresses to attend a football game in 1965. Jeans were the foundation of the hippie look. At first, young people wore the simple blue jeans of the working class as a sign of solidarity with working people. When the sight of middle-class kids wearing jeans was no longer shocking to older people, young people began to embellish their jeans with embroidery, paint, studs, and patchwork. This pair, owned by UNC alumnus George H. Simpson, was hand-patched from 1969 to 1972. The hip-hop musical genre exerted a significant influence on style in the 1990s. The photographs from the 1994 Yakety Yak. In keeping with the national Black is Beautiful movement, many Carolina students in the 70s wore Afro hairstyles and the dashiki, a loose-fitting pullover garment from West Africa with elaborate ornamentation. Yakety Yak, 1972. And there's also a side article, From Cheerleader to Hippie, with a photograph, Bernie Oakley, after growing long hair and a beard and identifying as a hippie, Yakety Yak, 1971. When Bernie Oakley first entered UNC in 1968, he was a clean-cut Carolina student and head freshman cheerleader. By the 1970s, he'd become a long-haired, politically radical hippie, drawn to the politics of the anti-Vietnam War movement. Oakley's beard and long hair got a lot of attention. Alumni demanded that he be kicked off the squad if he did not cut his hair. Oakley refused and was removed from the squad. Oakley explains his hairstyle. It was part of being recognized as someone in the counterculture. It took a long time to grow your hair from its traditional length to hippie length. The longer a guy's hair was, the longer he had been cool. And if you could grow a beard, it was even better. Extremely long hair, extremely long beard, tie-dyed t-shirts, worn-out jeans, handmade sandals, communal property. Everything our parents hated, that's what we loved. Oakley's story appeared in dozens of newspaper articles across the state. It was clear his style struck a generational nerve. Long hair symbolized the rejection of tradition as well as the defiance of gender conventions. At the time, long hair was seen as a style worn only by women. The next article is How Uniforms Have Changed by R. Jackson Marshall III, who is a deputy director of the North Carolina Museum of History. Throughout history, soldiers have worn different uniforms, which is a special kind of clothing that is worn by all the members of a group or organization, such as an army or a team, including helmets or hats, or have had unique body art tattoos to identify them as part of an army. In the past, what a soldier wore or how he looked at first glance might mean life or death in a battle. It is the same on the battlefields today. Long ago, in the days of Greeks or Romans or Vikings, soldiers wore distinctive helmets and carried shields with unique designs. This helped them identify their own soldiers from enemy soldiers in the frenzy of hand-to-hand fighting. Much later in time, between 1600 and 1900, Europeans designed fancy, bright-colored uniforms for their soldiers to wear to quickly show both friends and enemies which side they were on during a battle. Opposing soldiers stood in lines shoulder to shoulder, shooting at each other with muskets that covered the battlefield with dense smoke. The bright-colored uniforms helped them know who to shoot or not to shoot through the smoke. British soldiers, as an example, wore red uniforms, while the French and later the Americans wore blue uniforms. Of course, wearing bright colors also made soldiers clear targets for the enemy to shoot down. Is that crazy or not? By World War I, 1914 to 1918, the Europeans and Americans finally figured out that having their soldiers wear colorful uniforms in battle was a bad idea. Everyone decided to change uniforms to best hide their soldiers and keep them all from being shot down. So the British and Americans adopted a dark olive green uniform to match the ground and the woods. The Germans and French chose a dark gray or blue-gray uniform to blend in with the smoky and cloudy skies of European battlefields. By World War II, 1941 and 1945, American Army soldiers wore dark green uniforms, and U.S. Marines wore green camouflage uniforms to stay hidden from enemy soldiers. Today, American soldiers wear sandy brown camouflage uniforms when fighting in the desert terrain of the Middle East. Military uniforms have changed over time, but one thing has remained important. Soldiers must wear something different from the enemy they are fighting or risk killing the wrong people. Each country has chosen a uniform and helmet design that is unique for their soldiers to wear and knows what the enemy uniform looks like before going into battle. Here are the photograph captions. North Carolina Continental Line Uniform Reproduction, circa 1776. Wilmington Light Infantry, North Carolina Coast Artillery Corps, 1917. World War I helmet, gas mask, and case, circa 1917. Parker D. Robbins of Birdie County, 2nd U.S. Colored Cavalry in 1863, later helped draft the 1868 state constitution. Lieutenant Quentin Busby, Company K, 14th Regiment, North Carolina Troops, circa 1863. Officer's dress helmet worn by Lieutenant William E. Shipp of Lincolnton, Spanish-American War, 1898. Alfred Fowler, U.S. Army during the late 1960s or early 1970s. U.S. Army nurse uniform worn by Evelyn Whitlow, who in 1942 was one of the first American women taken as a prisoner of war during World War II. The next article is made especially for you by the Otey sisters. Otey is O-T-E-Y. The article is written by Kathy East, who is the editor of Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine. When Willie Otey Kay was a little girl in Raleigh, her grandmother taught her how to sew. No one guessed it would one day make her famous. Willie Otey Kay was born on March 17, 1894. She grew up with seven siblings in the vibrant black middle-class neighborhood in downtown Raleigh along Cabarrus and Harget Streets. Her father, Henry, owned Otey and Son Barbershop on Fayetteville Street. His all-white clientele includes some of the most important politicians and businessmen of the day. Willie and her sisters were a lot like other girls in the late 1800s. They learned to sew at a very young age. In those days, most young girls learned how to handle a needle and thread, whether they liked it or not. Boys usually didn't learn, even if they wanted to. When they grew up, young women were expected to be wives, mothers, and homemakers. Women made many of the family clothes at home instead of buying them in stores. But for Willie, sewing was more than a chore. She took to it instantly. "It always surprised my mother," she once said. "When she would make things for my sisters and me, I would copy them for my dolls." At the dawn of the 20th century, most people did not go to college, but Willie attended Shaw University, the first historically black university in the South, and the first in the United States to open its doors to women. While there, Willie earned a degree in home economics and won top prize for her dressmaking. In 1915, she married John Walcott Kay, a student at the university's Leonard Medical School. Soon, they moved to Wilmington to start a family and to follow John's dream, to start a hospital for African Americans. But in 1927, John died unexpectedly at age 37. Willie was stunned and heartbroken, and suddenly a widow with five young children. How would she support them now? I remembered that I majored in Shaw in home econometry, she later said, and it came to me that that's what I could start doing, start dressmaking. Willie moved back to Raleigh to live with her father. She set up shop at home where she could work with her children close by. She took a deep breath and bravely began a new career, Willie Kay, dressmaker. Back then, there was no social media, no Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook pages to get the word out. No eBay or Etsy or online stores for selling and buying clothes. But Willie's father helped provide a little advertising. I understand barbers like to talk as they work, Willie said, and I think he told his customers that I was sewing here at home. And then their wives and daughters began to come, and that's really how it began. Willie O.D.K. did not seek to create avant-garde fashion. Instead, she created beautiful formal clothing for men and women that suited the times. Soon everyone who was anyone wanted a K design. No one knew just how she chose her clients. But she was in such demand that everyone worked around her schedule. Once granted an appointment, customers came to her sewing room for consultations and measurements. Some knew exactly what they wanted. Others needed to look through the fashion magazines and drawings she kept handy. From governor's wives to prominent socialites, Willie Kay's clientele included a who's who of North Carolina society. As many as 50 or 60 young women and their mothers would seek a coveted appointment each year to have a debutante gown made. Less than half would ultimately be chosen to receive a dress due to Kay's busy schedule. Donna Kay Wright remembers watching her grandmother spend many, many long nights and days at the sewing machine, at which she seemed so content. It was like she entered into her own world when she sat down at the sewing machine. In Raleigh and beyond, the Odie name quickly became all the rage for fine formal wear. In addition to Willie, sister Mildred Odie Taylor established her own dressmaking business, as did Chloe Odie Gervais Laws and Josephine Odie Hayes, who lived in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Sister Elizabeth Odie Lizzie Constant excelled at beadwork and often embellished the dresses her sisters made. Although each had her own client base, the sisters would often help each other out. Kay witnessed dramatic change during her career, not just in fashion, but in society as well. Though Willie was not as vocal as some, she supported the civil rights movement in her own quiet ways. In 2016, the North Carolina Museum of History created the exhibit, Made Especially for You by Willie Kay, to tell the story of the Odie family and to showcase some of the beautiful designs. The museum exhibit was so popular that the museum transformed the story into an online exhibit. To learn more, visit Made Especially for You by the Odie Sisters of Raleigh at madeespeciallyforyou.org. Clothing exhibits like this one are important to anyone interested in history. Especially when well displayed, these artifacts become far more than mere objects hanging in a closet or tucked away in a cedar chest or museum storage. Because woven into the warp and weft are the threads of our history, our politics, and our social life. When looking at these clothes from the past, we can almost feel the presence of the people who once wore them, standing right there with us. We can imagine ourselves in their shoes and other clothes and remember a time that once was. Here are the photograph captions with this article. The Odie Sisters of Raleigh turned dreams into dresses for weddings, debuts, and other formal occasions. Mother of the Groom Dress, 1959. Party Dress, 1955. Second Night Debutante Gown, 1954. All dresses made by Willie Odie Kay, embellished by Elizabeth Odie Constant. Kayla Wright reads about one of the dresses created by her great-great-grandmother, Willie Odie Kay, while attending the museum's opening gala for the exhibit, January 2016. Willie Odie Kay with one of her designs. Willie Kay designed this gown for Cynthia Teal's April 5, 1969 wedding. Kay also made Teal's bridesmaids' dresses. Because the women lived out of state, Kay worked strictly for measurements. The women did not try on the gowns until shortly before the ceremony, and yet they all fit without alteration. In an era when many things in North Carolina were segregated, divided into separate groups by race, Willie Kay designed for both black and white clients. During her busiest times, she made an equal number of dresses for the Alpha Kappa Alpha Ball, predominantly African American, and the North Carolina Debutante Ball, predominantly white. Debutante Jane Haywood Rogers and debutante Natalie Wilson Perkins. The Odie sisters were talented, determined, and inseparable. There's a photograph with Chloe Odie Gervais Laws, Mildred Odie Taylor, Willie Odie Kay, Josephine Odie Hayes, and Elizabeth Odie Constant. There's an additional article accompanying this one, supporting the struggle. Willie Odie Kay witnessed dramatic change during her career, not just in fashion, but in society as well. Her daughter and son-in-law, June and Ralph Campbell, were leaders in the civil rights movement during the 1960s and 70s. And their son, Bill, was the first child to integrate Raleigh schools. Willie often escorted her grandson, Bill, home from school. Mildred Odie Taylor also advocated for change. As a founding member of the Raleigh Wake Citizens Association, a group of African American leaders who promoted improvements in the black community, she garnered support for appointing nurses to black schools, hiring African American police officers, and establishing Liggins School in Chavis Park. There's a photograph with this article. Willie Kay's daughter, June Campbell, accompanies her son, Bill, to the Murphy's School on September 7, 1960, the day he integrated the institution. Next article, washcloths, towels, and jeans, Carolina style. This is a closer look. When you take a bath or shower, do you think about your towels and washcloths? Do you think about the sheets you sleep in? How about the jeans you pull on in the morning before school? Who made them and where were they made? Today, the tags might say India, Sri Lanka, or China. But a generation ago, you probably would have seen the name of a North Carolina textile mill. During World War I, Cannon Mills, based in Kannapolis, began to produce a very absorbent material known as terry or Turkish cloth. Soon, Cannon became the top producer of towels in the country. The company also made sheets and other products. Greensboro is sometimes known as Jeansboro because of the denim produced there for decades by Cone Mills. There's a photograph accompanying this of Cannon towels from the 1960s and 70s, including a label that says Cannon Monticello. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.